Proudly presented by Paul Everett's RV Country. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, a special D-Day edition preparing you for the 72nd anniversary of the Normandy invasion with a man who will mark D-Day by skydiving in San Diego. A little different kind of jump than he made with the 501st Parachute Infantry Regiment on June 6, 1944. 94-year-old Tom Rice of Coronado, California, told us how he ended up behind enemy lines in the middle of the night. And when we left off, he had no idea where he was.
These guys were coming down the road. It must have been 8 or 10 of them coming down the road. And we clicked them and met them. And we stood up and kind of conversed. And one of them came to me and said, "I've got a hand grenade with the pin pulled. You cannot put the pin back in a hand grenade. It's not possible because the bend is bent."
Right.
And he probably didn't have the pin anyway. So here he is with a hand grenade, squeezing it like almighty. And if you ever let loose of it, that spoon goes up. You know what the hand grenade is like.
Yeah.
And it fires the cap, and it goes down the train of powder, and then 5 seconds it goes. Oh, he said, "I got a hand grenade with the pin pulled." I said, "Okay, give it to me." Had everybody get down. I got down and rolled over to the ditch, dropped it in the ditch, rolled back, and by the time I got to the middle of the road, the thing exploded, and I'm covered with water. So we went on down the road a little further. No enemy. What is this, the game we're playing here?
Hold on a second. Why did you want the hand grenade? Why did you put yourself in greater danger?
Because I was responsible for those guys, and I just took it on myself. I was a ranking guy there, even mm-hmm. though I may not have been. Mm-hmm. Ultimately, I found out who the guy was that had a hand grenade, and he was a lieutenant, and I'm just a staff sergeant.
But your leadership qualities,
there you go,
rose to the occasion.
Yeah, right. I had uh-huh. to. I had to.
Yeah. So, right, sorry for interrupting. I'm sure a lot of people are saying, "Wait, if that guy—that's his problem. That's not your problem."
So we broke up into groups and went on down the road. I'm saying to these guys, "Nothing's happening here, but I saw a house on the side of the road, about 50 yards back," and said, "We got to investigate this." So I set about 5 of them around to the back of the house. And Floyd Martin and me and another guy went to the front of the house. I said to Floyd Martin, "Don't bang on the door like an ugly American. Just knock, you know." He banged on it with his rifle, but you could hear it from probably 2 kilometers away. And after about 30 seconds or so, a Frenchman came to the door. Blasé as could be. Now, you wouldn't believe this. In a long, white nightgown from shoulder to floor. Mm-hmm. With a white tousled nightcap.
Wow.
With a dish with a candle in it lighted. Now, if you were in that situation, what would you think or say or do?
That's a good question. What'd you do?
I started to laugh.
I think I probably would have laughed.
I started to laugh like you can't believe. He didn't respond to anything, so I just pushed him aside and went in. 3 or 4 of the guys followed behind me, and I unloaded the map and put it on the floor and tried to get him to tell us where we were. He finally saw the word Carentan, and he pointed in that direction. His wife came out, dressed the same way. Uh-huh. That was no laugh. I didn't laugh at that one. After trying to talking with him and not frightening him, he said he'll want to be excused for a minute. So we did okay. So he went out, and he got 6 rounds of ammunition. He gave us 4, and he kept 2. And so we left right away. Assured him we're not going to do anything. Went out on the road again with 3 of us, walking in the ditch real low, and a lieutenant ahead of me yelled, "Hey, Sergeant, come here." Now, he was standing at a large gate where cattle would go in and come out, and it was a pasture field in there. He was standing there and said, "Sergeant, I want you to walk around this field on the edge. I'm going to stay right here and wait." He had a carbine rifle, a short one, with a metal stock on it. This guy was bound to, had it in his mind, he's going to get a sniper. I'm a bait.
Thanks a lot.
I knew it was exactly what he's doing, so I walked that perimeter 600 and some yards, and I had my trigger finger ready to go, and I had that submachine gun up, you know, looking into the trees. Mm-hmm. I got back to the point where he set me off. He was gone. I learned a couple things. Never arrive at your point of departure as a final destination, because they could have seen it, uh-huh. could have watched me. 50-some years later, New York staff writer called, wanting to come out and interview me. He took 100 pictures of me for all what reason, I don't know. Then he started asking questions. And on the question period, he asked me to explain some heroism. I said they were all heroes. And then it hit me. I'll explain what happened right there. And I told him what happened, what that lieutenant did. I said, this is a situation of cowardice. They printed that story. They printed my picture with it. And I hope that son of a gun saw it.
If he made it through the war.
If he made it, yeah. I figured this guy's going to get somebody killed. But so we wandered around there, out in fields, and a horse was had been hit with shrapnel. A medic I had with me, Robert Schill, he patched him up with sulfadiazone, and we used the horse as a protection to get to some other point. Went into a house, searching the houses, and I crossed a window, and I had a rifle shot come through for the sniper. It hit just in front of me and caught me in the leg. It was a hard, like I was hit like a baseball bat almost, you know. So I could pull the pant leg up and pulled it out and put it in my pocket. I never know what happened to it after that.
So this is your first day.
Yeah.
And you're already hit.
First day. This is June 6th.
And you've already got a wound in your leg.
Yeah, I got a wound that I didn't pay too much attention to. It didn't bother me that much, crying out loud. I'm not going to a medic and say, give me a Purple Heart or make a record of this baloney. But I've known lieutenants who've done that.
Sure.
But we began to hook up with some of the guys. And on the road, we found maybe 15 or 20 of them. Major Allen was there. He organized us into a small group, put our packs down, drop our packs, don't take anything else with you except your ammunition. We're heading toward La Barquette Lock. Now, the set of locks there. And the Germans closed the locks to flood the entire area.
Right.
The locks were closed. We were going to open them. Now, by the time the locks were opened and the water flowed out and drained into the English Channel, the battle would have been miles beyond it. So I figured, this is a phony, crazy, stupid objective. But we went down there, and we ran into the 6th German Parachute Infantry Regiment. They were 3,000 in strength. The battalions were in two or three different places. One was in Perrier, and they were having a good time. They were having a party. And a messenger came in and said, they're coming, they're coming. The aircraft were coming in. They weren't bombarding yet, but he heard all these aircraft coming, and the parachutes are dropping. In the British zone, they dropped dummy parachutes with explosives on them. So when they hit the ground, the explosive went to attract all the Germans over there. So things were pumping on the ground. So Colonel Heidi, who was the commanding officer there, he got these guys organized. One battalion was to go to the beach.
And we're talking about the German forces.
Yeah.
Now. Colonel Heidi was with the,
right,
with the German forces.
See, they were 300 feet above us.
And you said 3,000 strong. How many do you think were with you?
It was 50.
3,000 versus 50?
50. Well, not quite yet. They were broken into three battalions.
Okay.
And the battalion, one battalion was to go to the beachhead and to get in between us and the landing forces to disrupt that landing.
Right.
We met them at a place called Pinamy. Their second battalion evidently was a little bit north, but near the beach, they were coming south. Rifles slung on their shoulder. Did you see Saving Private Ryan?
Sure.
You remember these guys taken out with that captain looking for Private Ryan, smoking cigarettes and rifles slung?
Yep.
These Germans were singing their national anthem and whatnot. Going toward Carentan, another battalion was in another opposite direction, some distance from them, going to W4, which was a blockhouse. They had Goliaths there with 200 pounds of dynamite on little automatic wheelbarrow kind of thing, and they would control them by radio, and they wanted to get those things in there to blow up any of the American forces that were coming in. But when the guys did come in, they W4 had been knocked out, and these crazy little machines were running around. The guys would go up to them, put hand grenades on them, and then back off. And that's what would. But anyway, we got into a big battle with maybe 400 Germans.
And this is, now we're hearing why you said earlier that you had the worst possible drop.
Yeah.
So there's 50 of you, there's 400 Germans. And it's still dark?
It's light.
The sun has come up. It's the morning of June 6th.
Yeah.
And what do you have personally to use against the enemy?
My Thompson submachine gun.
Uh-huh.
But on the way down to La Barquette Lock. Three of us were ordered to go to the lock and outpost it. So I didn't get to Penemy, which was maybe 300 yards from me. I was at La Barquette Lock. So we outposted it that night. We figured some of the Germans in Carentan are going to come down on patrols, mm-hmm. whatnot. 400 of them are in battle with 50 Americans. We captured them all.
Wow.
Amazing. Captured them all. So we set up that night because I figured certainly there's going to be some Germans coming down finally trying to find out what's going on. I set up about six stakes. I set wire between the stakes. We hung wire from the stakes vertically and tied tin cans on them. In the tin cans, I put bolts and nuts and all kinds of things. I mean, it's a silly thing, but it's kind of creative there. Mm-hmm. So any patrol coming through has to come down that way. And he's not going to be able to see that because it's so dark and the metal is dark and it's kind of low. He's going to trip on it. 2 o'clock in the morning, patrol came through. I was situated right in the corner. The orchard is long leg and the short leg. I was right in the corner of the short leg. The other two guys were on the long leg. And we were tied together wrist to wrist with parachute suspension line. If any noise or anything you hear comes through there, you're alerted for some reason. We stayed 2 hours on and then slept. We alternated that. Just jerked those cords, and we just start shooting out there. German patrol came through. We got one of them. He might have been his only man. I'm not sure. Can't prove it. But he was out there, and he moaned all night long. One of the guys had experience as working in a mortuary, so he took his trench knife and went out there and finished him off. And so we pulled him in the morning. We dug a trench for him in the orchard, and we cut some limbs off the tree and made a cross out of it. I still have his parachute wings, cloth wings. I hid them on my shoe, so if I ever captured with those things, boy, I'd be in real trouble. And none of us got hit.
None of them were hit there, but Tom would be wounded again during the Battle of the Bulge. He is a recipient of the Purple Heart and the Bronze Star, and he'll be parachuting Monday on the 72nd anniversary of D-Day. When we come back, we'll hear how President Franklin D. Roosevelt addressed the nation on June 6, 1944, and then get Tom's explanation of why he jumps out of an airplane every year now on June 6th. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Remember when the bank gave you free checking and savings accounts, even making money for you when you kept your dollars there? Paul Leffler here to say I've recaptured those days, and you can too with EECU. It's not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that just keeps growing and growing. The newest branch is in Tulare, and nearly 250,000 EECU members represent 10 different California counties. As little as $250 in a savings account earns you dividends. And access is so easy. 30,000 ATMs, free mobile banking. And I haven't even told you what I love most about EECU, the credit union's support of causes up and down our area, like Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 500 World War II veterans have gotten to see their memorial in Washington, D.C. for free because of the leadership and financial support of EECU. Ready to join the team yet? Call 1-800-538-3328. Paul Everett's RV Country has 8 locations in 5 western states, including Fresno and Indio, California, Bullhead City, Arizona, Laughlin, Nevada, Coburg, Oregon, right off the I-5, and 3 locations in Washington, Fife, Milton, and Mount Vernon. Over 55 years of experience serving the needs of RVers across the country and proud supporters of Hometown Heroes. Find a location near you by visiting rvcountry.com.